You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast series, Evolving Evidence in the Management of Patients with Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Clinical Pearls for the Community Practitioner. In this episode, we discuss the latest clinical trial data surrounding the management of advanced non-small cell lung cancer without actionable drivers using immune checkpoint inhibitors. My name is Dr. Sunali Wadera, and I am pleased to host today's podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Renato Martins, Chief of Hematology Oncology and Palliative Care and Professor of Medicine at Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center of Virginia Commonwealth University of Richmond, Virginia. Let's start with a brief case for our discussion. Jeremiah is a 66-year-old male who presents to your clinic with shortness of breath and cough. He indicates that he is a former smoker. Based on CT PET scans and biopsy, you diagnose him with lung adenocarcinoma, metastasized to the brain and adrenal gland, with PD-L1 TPS 90%. New data is constantly emerging surrounding the role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in managing metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Can you describe recent clinical data that is pertinent to this patient case and could inform treatment selection?
Absolutely. First, Sunali, let me thank you for inviting me to participate in this podcast. As you know, I'm coming back to work today for the first time after having a pretty significant bike accident where I broke multiple ribs. So I may be speaking a little bit slower than I normally would because I'm trying to control my chest movements as much as possible. It's really pretty amazing to think that the first two publications on the New England Journal of Medicine regarding immunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer occurred in 2012. So this last June, it's been 12 years since we understood that immunotherapy can be effective in this disease. And this has been a journey that is really very crowded with data. I think there are over 20 different immunotherapy FDA approvals in non-small cell lung cancer in different clinical settings. You know, this case is a specific pointing out to the issue of patients with metastatic disease and a very high PD-L1 expression with a TPS of 90%. I think we understand very clearly that PD-L1 is a biomarker that guides our therapy, and there is data showing that at least three different immunotherapy agents, namely tezolizumab, pembrolizumab, and cemiplimab, can be used as single agent therapy when patient has a tumor with a high PD-L1 expression, which is defined as a TPS score greater than 50%. Evidently, that is in the context of not having any driver mutations. I think that this small case summary does not specifically state that this adenocarcinoma did not have a driver mutation. That needs to be tested irrespective of someone's smoking history. But for the purpose of this discussion, we're going to assume that it was tested and it was negative. So in that context, I think it's perfectly reasonable to consider the use of a single agent immunotherapy based in three separate randomized clinical trials that have shown that in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival, the use of immunotherapy for these patients has superior results to chemotherapy. So I want to make just one more point before we end this discussion about single agent therapy in this clinical scenario. And that is that at times, we do consider using combination therapy in this setting. And I do that when I am concerned that I'm going to have only one bite at the apple. What do I mean by that? If someone has a high PD-L1 expression, but their response rate is in the 40 to 50% range, and they have a significant amount of visceral involvement, for example, I may not have the opportunity to try chemotherapy if they were not able to respond to immunotherapy because they may be too sick, too much of a deterioration of the performance status to allow for another line of treatment. And in that specific situation, I think it makes sense to consider a combination of chemo and immunotherapy upfront, even in patients with a high PD-L1 expression.
Now, what data is available that can help you decide between atezolizumab, cemiplimab, and pembrolizumab for this patient?
So, as I described before, it's certainly a pretty crowded environment. And one thing that I think is generally accepted is that there are no significant differences in toxicity for single agent immunotherapy. Evidently, when you deploy combination immunotherapy, as for example would be the case with nivolumab and ipilimumab, you have higher rates of severe toxicity. Still obviously acceptable, but certainly higher rates than you would see with a single agent therapy. So toxicity is not a differentiating factor. Another factor that one could consider is convenience. So for some patients, that convenience may be important. The third very important issue is cost. And unfortunately, over time, we have had therapies that have similar targets and have been approved in sequence, but with very little price difference. It's my understanding that that's not the case here, that there is indeed a price difference between these agents. And I don't want to get into the details of that because I don't know for sure the numbers and I don't want to make any mistakes in that area. But I think that that is also a consideration and something that perhaps clinicians should be more aware than we generally are.
Well, thank you for your feedback. With regards to that, you mentioned that there are no significant differences in toxicities between the agents. What are some common adverse events that have been evidenced in patients receiving these treatment regimens?
Yeah, so when you are as old as I am, and I'm one of the authors of one of those first two trials in the New England Journal of Medicine. So I've been using immunotherapy, I think since 2009, about 3 years before the publication of the paper. What I tell my patients is that basically anything can happen. You know, you have, fortunately, very rare complications like myocarditis or CNS toxicities that are quite traumatic, but again, they are also rare. And then you have things that are also rare. You know, overall, the risk of severe toxicities, if you look across trials, is probably in the 5 to about 7%. That doesn't mean that the grade 3 toxicities are going to be in that range. But for example, if you develop grade 3 thyroid toxicity, that can be corrected relatively easily. I'm talking about toxicities that have a more substantial impact in people's quality of life. So when we look at dose, obviously the most fear, and among those severe ones, most common, is pneumonitis. It's very important that there is a very high degree of suspicion for this complication. Patients that come into your clinic and complain that there has been a change in their baseline shortness of breath and they're coughing more, I would say the vast majority of those in our clinic will be investigated that same day for the presence of pneumonitis and will not receive, you know, further therapy until that has been clarified. But again, everything can happen, right? I saw today in my clinic someone that after many months of therapy developed progressive worsening joint pains, the therapy had already been discontinued because of other reasons, and was placed on steroids with almost complete resolution of her symptoms. And it's currently on a steroid tapering regimen. We've seen toxicities that even after discontinuing therapy can resolve very, very slowly. Probably the most clear example of that is rash. In fact, if I can tell you an anecdote, one of the first patients that I treated with immunotherapy in the context of a clinical trial, he is a man who is a nuclear physicist from Los Alamos. And he came to see me, and after receiving one first line of chemotherapy, he ended up enrolling on a second line trial of immunotherapy versus second line chemotherapy and had a really excellent response to treatment. But developed a progressively worsening psoriatic type rash. And despite dermatology involvement and multiple topic and intermittent systemic therapy, the rash just kept getting worse and worse, up to a point that we had to discontinue treatment. And being a very smart man, he asked me a very astute question. He asked me back then if his rash ever went away, would his cancer become active again? And at that point, I didn't know the answer to that. I would say that much more likely than not, the answer to that question now is no. There is not a direct parallel between the persistent sea of toxicities and the continuation of response.
Okay, that helps a lot. Now, you talked about some various adverse events that you have seen in your practice. Is there anything you would like to add about effective strategies to mitigate and manage events that you might see?
Yeah, so one thing that I tell my patients is that it's really hard to give you a complete laundry list of symptoms that would be associated with autoimmune reactions that can affect pretty much every organ. What I tell them is that if they develop new symptoms that are impacting their quality of life, they should let us know, and we will judge, you know, how aggressively this needs to be investigated. I think that partnership with the patients and their families is absolutely critical on the management of possible side effects of immunotherapy.
Okay, thank you so much. In the future, where should clinicians focus their attention when assessing new data on these agents that we have discussed?
Yeah, it's only going to get more and more complicated, right? I mean, the reality is that even in patients that have a pretty high PD-L1 expression, the response rate is still far from 100%. In fact, if you take across the board 50% or greater, which is a somewhat heterogeneous population because we know that the higher the PD-L1 expression, the higher the likelihood of response. But if you take the 50% or greater, the response rate is still in the 40 to 50% range, which makes PD-L1 a very imperfect biomarker. So there is definitely room for improvement. And what you will see going forward is multiple other immune checkpoint pathway inhibitors or even some immune stimulating agents being added to the backbone the PD-1 and PD-L1 targets we have today to try to improve these responses. That is already happening, and we have seen data on LAG-3, for example, in lung cancer, and that is only going to increase with more and more trials trying to explore the different possible combinations that will increase the response rate of immunotherapy, but hopefully not adding to the observed toxicities of this treatment.
Thank you so much. That's all the time that we have for today. I would like to thank Dr. Martins for taking the time to speak today about the latest available clinical trial data surrounding the management of advanced non-small cell lung cancer without actionable driver mutations using immune checkpoint inhibitors. And thank you for joining us. We hope you will listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity.